It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Casey, how are you?
I'm doing well. The better question is, how are you? You're back this week.
I'm back.
You are back, and we're glad to have you.
And I wasn't ill or playing hooky or anything. I was on the road handling a number of trials last week, and it rendered me slightly unavailable.
Absolutely. And we're glad you're back, and because there's so much to talk about.
Did you save up all the juicy stuff for me?
Absolutely. There is a... Actually, this is a very disturbing story, and it's a tragic story. This came out of Dane County. It was a case from a recent case where there was basically the facts, as I understand it, there was a stepsister who ran from her family's home in the Madison area. A passing motorist noticed her on the streets, this woman, and she was barefoot. She was only wearing light pajamas. She was actually a 15-year-old girl, but the person who saw her believed that she was about 8 years old because of the way she looked. She was down to 68 pounds.
Good heavens.
She was, and this motorist stopped by and essentially helped her out and gave her a ride, and ultimately the police were contacted. There was this big investigation, and the stepmother and the father were alleged to have kept her in the basement with boarded up windows, and the stepmother apparently beat her, and the stepbrother allegedly tried to have sex with her. Now, since that time, this was a huge case down in the Madison area. All three of them have been convicted. I believe there was one jury trial and a couple of them entered pleas. And Judge Julie Genovese in Madison, a Dane County Circuit Court judge, sentenced each of them to 5 years in prison. There was outrage after this from many in the community, or I should say not many, but some in the community who were very vocal about this, saying that she didn't get enough time and that these people didn't get enough time for what happened to her. It's difficult to comprehend this because, of course, you and I and our listeners presumably weren't in the courtroom when these proceedings were going on, didn't have a time to listen to the investigation, to listen to the evidence, to describe why this happened. But essentially, there were circumstances where I believe the judge referred to this brother as having socially bizarre norms in the family. He was actually a teenager when he apparently sexually assaulted this girl.
Right.
And so there was a big debate about this, and there was serious dysfunction in the home. Now, the issue is that Judge Genovese made some comments to the effect of that, you know, this other guy, I don't know if she used the term victim, but sort of implied that he was sort of a victim of his own circumstances. And although certainly what he did was abhorrent and wrong, that he also, she had to take into consideration his circumstances. And now there's been sort of a push, I think unfortunately so, to impeach her. Or at least there's been an online petition to impeach this judge.
Well, you know, I think that happens more often than we hear about, because I think the general public, there's a good reason why court is open to the public, and that when people want to know how the process works and occurs, they should go to court and watch. They shouldn't just look at what the offense is and then hear what the sentence is without knowing more and then render an opinion, because that's not how our system works. Now, one might say, and I guess I'd have to agree, that just on its face, somebody that is depriving a child of a normal existence by keeping that person prisoner in the basement certainly should, if you're only looking at that aspect of it, receive a harsher sentence than merely 5 years. On the other hand, there are so many factors that a judge is responsible for determining, not just making everybody feel good at the end of the day, because they're dealing with specific defendants with specific circumstances. You and I have discussed this many times, but we've evolved into a culture over the years where we view the criminal justice system as a method by which to help people's conscience feel better. And we view it as a tool that helps people recover from trauma or from unfortunate circumstances. And it does have a legitimate role to some extent addressing those types of issues. On the other hand, the judge's role is much more complicated than that. And the judge has to weigh and balance things and should not be concerned with the possibility that there could be an impeachment proceeding, you know, or a request for an impeachment filed. Now, I'm not even sure that's the correct method of of trying to address the situation, because in Wisconsin, we elect our judges, and there are specific provisions whereby a complaint can be filed with the Judicial Commission that investigates and determines whether or not there's judicial misconduct. But I will guarantee you that a sentence that some people think is too light does not fall within the category of actionable misconduct of a judge. In fact, that's why the judge is the judge, right? I always say this to my clients. See the dude on the bench, or the lady on the bench that's wearing the black robe? Well, he or she gets to decide your fate and doesn't have to listen to or abide by any plea agreement. That's why he or she got elected, you know, and that's why they give them these black robes, is because it signifies that they are really independent from the rest of us in the courtroom. So, you know, it bothers me when I hear these stories about people trying to take some kind of action against a judge because they feel that the judge was too light, or for that matter, too harsh on the sentence. But we don't see that very often, do we?
We don't see
people objecting to judges being overly harsh.
You're too harsh. I don't like that. You're right. But you know what? But I think that when we look at this, and you think about the federal system, which, you know, has essentially is boiled down to almost like a formula where you find out what somebody's sentence is going to be based on all of these different factors. But it's judges are supposed to have discretion, and you and I have talked about mandatory minimums and how in many cases it's not a good idea because it takes discretion away from judges. It doesn't allow them to consider the unique facts and circumstances of each case. And to me, that's not justice. Justice is looking at each specific case on its own and determining from that case. Because, you know, you can look at any case. You could say, okay, you know, why don't we talk about some sort of, I don't know, burglary, right? And we look at that and we go, oh, that's bad. Well, okay, what are the unique facts and circumstances of that case? Why is it so bad? Are there mitigating circumstances to it? Has the person rehabilitated themselves? There's so many other things that you can take into consideration.
That is another good point, because a very important, although not exclusively significant portion of what our criminal justice system is supposed to achieve, but extremely important, is that rehabilitative component of it. And what a judge has to do is look at what is required in order to ensure that, number one, the public is protected, number two, the punishment fits the crime, but also what rehabilitative needs the individual defendant has. In fact, a judge is supposed to first consider whether probation is, or, you know, a rehabilitative type sentence is possible given the circumstances. That can sometimes result in what we might consider to be a more lenient prison sentence, or in fact probation for certain things. But you know what, Casey, you're right. I don't agree with you on everything. In fact, I like to disagree with you.
I know you do.
It's just much more fun. But I'm going to have to agree with you on this one.
Oh, we can isolate this.
Wait. Yeah. You know, Casey always, whenever I say something like that, which is, you know, maybe once a year, he tells.
I want to isolate the audio.
He tells Casey over in the other room, Kelly Myers, somebody, isolate that clip and play it over and over again. And then, you know, they try and put it to a drum beat or something. I've heard you guys mess
around
like that. It's
a wonderful thing.
It turns into a mixtape or something.
Because if I'm ever getting down, I just keep playing that.
Yeah.
That's what really helps.
Said, Casey was right. Boom, 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 boom.
Right.
Casey
just
was right.
It just lifts my spirit. So,
but anyway, Casey, you are right about this, in the sense that you know, what's becoming newsworthy about this story isn't what should be news. What should be newsworthy and what we should be paying attention to is the tragedy of the crime itself, and preferably some reporting on the circumstances that led to these sentences that are not what you would expect. I mean, that is interesting. I'd like to know more about why the judge felt that was appropriate. I'm not just going to say 5 years, that's a terrible sentence, and then circulate a petition and then file it with whomever. It's not going to do anything. I mean, that's...
And let's be clear. I don't at all, for one second, hold it against the victim and her family for being outraged by anything here.
Oh, sure.
Because the victim and her family have gone through a lot. They know what they think should happen, but there's a reason we don't have victims who decide what the outcome should be.
Well, that's why I was kind of getting at that before, that I think we don't have an entitlement as a society to be free from outrage. That's not why the courts are there. They're not there to make it so that we're all happy all the time. And yes, it's true that if something terrible happens to you and if it's somebody else's fault, there are things that can be done. But that court system is not there exclusively for the victim to be made whole. I mean, it's part of it, but that's not all of it.
And this person who was sentenced, one of them was apparently a teenager when he did these things. Now, in some circumstances, teenagers aren't even charged with these types of offenses. So, you know, you can look at it from a number of different angles. There's no doubt that what happened to this victim, and she is a victim, was horrible and deplorable and wrong and should not be tolerated in any kind of society, let alone ours. You also have to look at, however, what is the appropriate punishment in this case?
Yeah.
And in this situation, I don't know. I mean, you could make an argument the punishment should have been more. You can also make an argument that the punishment is what it should have been. I mean, 5 years in prison is no easy feat. And so when you're doing those types of things, I think there's an incredible pressure on judges, unfortunately, in this day and age of where we've got people commenting on websites after every news article, oh, this was too light, this was too light, this was what, you know, whatever the case may be, it's an unfortunate pressure. But we have to take a break. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
To Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Kirk.
And I'm Casey.
Well, you know, Casey, when we left off, we were talking about the case in Dane County where the judge sentenced the three defendants to 5 years in prison and some of the public outrage that's been raised in the context of all that. And I was starting to make the point before we left for the commercial messages that graced us just a few minutes ago, that this perception that we have in our society that we need to be tougher on crime, we need to send more people to prison, and that it's that's the solution to the problems. And by specifically enforcing that in a way where people complain against the judge or try and file some sort of silly impeachment type thing. But you know what? If you look at our country as a in terms of how we operate as a society of corrections and the big business that we perpetuate by having people incarcerated, we have a higher percentage of our population incarcerated than virtually all countries except three or four in the entire world.
Certainly all industrialized countries.
All industrialized countries, correct. And you have to exclude some that have political prisoners, like I don't think you can count North Korea in that equation because we don't really know how many people are in prison in North Korea. Did you read the human rights violation report?
Yeah, it was horrible.
It's 360 pages of it looks like, you know, something that you would dream up. It's so ridiculous. It's like a movie from the 1940s that somebody imagined, like science fiction-ish. You know?
Right. Well, they're an isolated society. I mean,
yeah,
they have
that's
no
the whole,
connection to the outside world.
It's so bizarre that they're, as technology progresses, they go overboard to, well, not overboard. I mean, they actually effectively do stop the North Koreans from knowing what the rest of the world is like. I mean, they don't have internet access. They don't have – it's against the law to own a radio that hasn't been fixed in such a way that you can't, you know, do – anyway, the point is there are countries like that where a lot of people are just in prison for no particular reason. But we incarcerate such a tremendous proportion of our population if you're looking generally speaking. Add to that the fact that if you are looking at people in minority classes – we are by far the leader in the world for incarceration rates of minorities within our society. And there are reasons for this that are very hard to define. And they've spent years and years trying to, you know, to help curb this issue.
It's complicated.
Some people would argue that it's a result of us being tougher on crime, and it means that that's why the streets are getting safer, because we're putting more and more people in prison. But you cannot have a system that just removes and isolates people that are committing undesirable acts. I mean, it's like if your dog was doing something that he should be trained not to do. Let's say he's using the indoor carpet as though it were the outdoor potty spot, and you know, you don't kill the dog. You don't put the dog in a closet for a month, because you correct the behavior. You help the dog learn. And I'm not saying we're all like dogs. What I'm saying is that, you know, we're an intelligent species on the planet, and there are things that we can do utilizing our education and our logic and our resources. And you know, there are tax dollars that are supposed to go towards solving problems. And when you throw in this kind of stuff, and I know it was a sad case, and I know it was terrible, and it was emotional, but you know, if you want to vote for somebody else the next time the judge is up for election, be my guest. You know, that's how it works. But yeah. You also have a duty to be informed before you render an opinion about that. You know, we live in a free speech society. You know that.
Well, I want to speak on not judging a book by its cover.
Sure.
Because there was a prominent attorney in Wisconsin, Dan Rotier, who pled guilty to battery, and he was placed in a first offenders program. And there's more to this story than meets the eye. This is from the Wisconsin State Journal. It says a prominent Madison personal injury lawyer pleaded guilty Friday, Friday before, to misdemeanor battery for a domestic incident at his home, and he said that he used alcohol to deal with the stress of fighting an aggressive form of cancer that could end his life. He said that it's my hope and intent to work through this in my remaining days in an appropriate manner. So it sounds like this is probably terminal. Mm-hmm. Rotier, who is president of Habish and Rotier, was arrested at his Maple Bluff home February 7th. After he allegedly hit his wife on the back with his cane during an argument. At the time, his blood alcohol concentration was 0.13%, well above the legal limit.
Wait. Legal limit for what? Swinging a cane around?
They say well above the legal limit for drivers in Wisconsin.
I know.
He
wasn't driving. That bothers me. That grinds my gears.
I know.
Say above the legal limit. For what? I mean, if you're driving, then there's a legal limit. But if you're doing something else.
Right.
I say that. But
if you have a weapon.
Right. If you have a weapon, then it's kind of like driving, because they can charge you with operating a weapon, you know, or possession of a weapon while intoxicated.
Well, and he pleaded guilty to misdemeanor domestic battery. And as part of his plea agreement, dangerous weapon penalty enhancer was dismissed. The judge agreed at the recommendation to put Attorney Rotier, in a first offenders program. And if he completes the requirements of that program, the charge would be dismissed. If he doesn't, he could face up to 9 months in jail. Now, this was a story that I looked at first blush, and I said, okay, you know, even as a defense attorney, I said, that looks pretty bad. I mean, you know, if you're hitting your wife with a cane and you're drunk and all that, that certainly looks bad, right?
Sure.
But when you think about, and it is bad, but when you also consider the surrounding circumstances, there's absolutely no excuse for hitting his wife. I'm merely saying that when he went into that situation, obviously there were reasons why he was intoxicated, right? He was suffering from a very serious form, is suffering from a very serious form of cancer that he believes will end his life. And again, no excuse for hitting his wife. I'm not saying that. I'm merely saying that there is more to a person's surrounding circumstances than meets the eye. And when you consider those, oftentimes we look at these things in a vacuum and we go, here's the charge, here's what this person should get, and here's why. And this is an example of somebody who is certainly ought to be punished because he hit his wife with a cane, and that's bad.
I mean, it raises the issue that I think we've debated so many times about, is it good for society or bad for society to have such wide public access to what's going on in a case? And the reason I say that is that here, you know, Mr. Dan Rotier is a well-known attorney. I mean, he is the president of, I think, the biggest law firm in the state. I think I'm safe in saying that. Well, at least Wisconsin-based law firm
in
the state.
Yeah, maybe some of them in Milwaukee, but I don't know.
Yeah, but in terms of the number of offices they have and the number of lawyers that they employ, it's pretty substantial. Right, and it's well-known as one of the top-notch law firms in the state in that regard. You see his face on commercials all the time because, they talk about all their different offices and things like that. So a well-known name, a well-respected person in the legal community. And it's unfortunate that every day of this man's life that he spent working hard to contribute to that business and for years and years and years and years. Now we see the unflattering mugshot in the newspaper and the public story about how this man has now come to be defined by this incident. He's the guy that dealt with his cancer by drinking and hitting his wife with a cane, and that's what he becomes. Now, what ends up happening is a good thing in the sense that he enters into a first offenders program because that's appropriate. Somebody makes it to that age without committing a crime and never having this problem before, and something goes wrong.
Hey, 62.
He's going through a life crisis, perhaps even an end-of-life crisis, and has a bad day and does something bad.
Right.
But no longer is his 40 years of practicing law what defines, and now it's this one night. Okay, so the justice system does the right thing by putting him into this first offenders program, probably results in him not having a significant punishment to worry about, motivates him to do the right thing, to reflect on his behavior, to apologize, to seek treatment, to take his situation seriously and do all the good things that we hope we can guide that person to do. But you know what? What's left behind, whether that works or not, is the newspaper story that you have on your desk right now,
right.
And it's in ink, and it's got the nasty picture of Dan Rotier on there that everybody says, ooh, that looks bad. He's wearing a jail uniform and everything. So, but what do you think, Casey? I mean, should we... have we gotten to the point in our society where the public's interest in knowing that, say, Justin Bieber or, give me another one of those pop icons that you love so much.
I can only think of Justin Bieber. That's all I can think of.
Don't other people like that get in trouble?
Miley Cyrus?
Miley Cyrus,
I don't know if she's gotten any criminal trouble, but
she behaves badly. Well, Lindsay Lohan, how about that?
Right, okay, there
you go. Those
types
of things. And, we have such a saturation of these controversies that we're... Yeah, I admit it. I'm interested to see what's going on with this kind of thing. And I find it salacious and I find it, what's that person gotten themselves into? But you know what? It's the kind of thing that competes with other goals within our justice system that sometimes can't be met.
Well, and this type of program that can help people who... And it certainly punishes them in the sense that they have this conviction. Unless they complete this, they can face jail time if they don't complete it. One prime example in Sheboygan County that I think is an excellent endeavor is the Sheboygan County Veterans Court. That is a wonderful court, and Judge Sakevich in the Sheboygan County Veterans Court is the person who presides over the Veterans Court. And it's got many wonderful volunteers and people who go in there because realize.
It was her initiative. Actually.
It was her initiative, right. That's what I understand. And when people go into it, veterans who we value and who we respect, if they've made a mistake, this gives us an opportunity because they've served their country after all.
Right. And I just want to point out that some people misunderstand what that's all about. It's not because they've served our country and we're trying to be lenient with them. It's because many of our veterans, because of what they've been through, whether they've been in combat or not, but
yes.
Certainly it's made worse by combat, have unique treatment needs because of injuries or post-traumatic stress and the toll that it takes on one's family. Having been in that situation myself where, you go off to another country and you don't think you're coming back, it changes you forever in a lot of different ways. So I think it recognizes the fact that we have an identifiable population that has a unique treatment need where we can put effective resources to use.
Absolutely. And we need more of that type of thing. We will be back with more Legal Defense in just a moment with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense. Presents with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Every breath you take, and every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take, I'll be watching you every single day, and every word you say, every game you play, every night you stay, I'll be watching you.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Aubert.
All right, Kirk. There is a bill that this was a really interesting case. Brian Cooper, this is a case from Wisconsin, allegedly raped and strangled a pregnant woman after she rejected his request essentially for a deeper relationship. And this was at a Door County hotel. The defense in this case was that Mr. Cooper was too drunk to have intended to murder this woman and her unborn child.
Mm. Oh, did this case go to trial finally?
I believe yes, it did. The alcohol that he drank during and after the wedding, according to the defense, inhibited his ability to form intent. Now, he was convicted of sexual assault, but the jury hung on first degree intentional homicide. There was apparently intended to vote in favor of guilt. So there's now a retrial that's been ordered, and I think it's coming up in the next several months.
Right, right. That's what I was. I knew that that was out there. I just didn't know when it was happening. But yeah, I'm pretty familiar with this case.
It's interesting. So Cooper was apparently not the child's father, and they're saying that he admitted to the rape. The jury foreman disagreed over the meaning of one of the jury instructions that was given, and that said, if the defendant was so intoxicated that the defendant did not intend to kill the alleged victim, you must find the defendant not guilty of first-degree intentional homicide. Now, there's been a law in place since what I understand to be 1988 allowing for a defense of voluntary intoxication in cases where a person could not form the intent because they were either right, too impaired by alcohol or drugs. Now, that law has been in place. It's been the legislature has tried to repeal it.
Well, let me slow you down a little, I know where you're going with this. Okay, and
okay.
I know where you're going with this.
All right, you got it.
But there's a reason why that law, and I can guarantee you that in the 80s there was not a group of legislators that got together and said, "Hey, we really need to defend the opportunity for people to drink massive amounts of alcohol because if you're not allowed to present that as a defense, it will just make our society crumble at the seams." No, it actually addresses a very specific issue in the law that has long been recognized, both under common law and our own form of constitutional law that we have utilized in the United States since we became the United States. But even going back to common law in England prior to the formation of our government, there's been a recognition that there's certain types of elements of an offense. And when there's an element that requires simply what we call general intent, that would mean that the person has the intent to do a thing. Like, let's say I'm going to walk across the street. Well, I have the general intent to walk across the street. But if I'm intending to walk across the street and give the one-fingered salute to a police officer that goes by, and if my intent is to offend a police officer because he is a police officer, if I shout out, you know, "I don't like you pigs," or something like that. See, now I'm doing something that's beyond just the general intent to do a thing. Now I have the mental purpose and understanding to have specific intent. A better example would be, and a lot of these actually do come up in the context of police batteries and things like that. If I'm in a fight with somebody and it turns out that it's a police officer and I don't know that, I can't be charged with intentional assault of a police officer because there's that additional element that I have to know it was a police officer and then intend to assault that police officer. So then you ask, well, what if he's wearing a badge and has a gun? Well, that's where this intoxication stuff comes in, because it is possible that someone has that level of intoxication. Let's not forget, it is not illegal to be extremely drunk all
right
by itself. Okay,
right.
That is not against the law at all. All right. Now, if you're drunk in public and you're creating a nuisance or a problem, let me put it this way. It's not against the law to be quietly and peacefully schnockered. Okay. You could be.
Now, is that the legal term?
That
for
is
it?
The
I'm
legal
not sure.
term. You could be, 12 sheets to the wind, but as long as you're quietly, peacefully doing so, you're not breaking any law. So we have to incorporate the fact that we have this requirement that has always been there for good reason, because we don't want to have an allegation of specific intent without a method of proving that. So the way that we prove that is by circumstantial evidence of the person's mental state. And because that's what we do, and because we don't have our brains hooked up to computers, and we have to guess or at least apply some presumptions, logic, common sense as to why people do things that they're doing and what their thoughts are, it's an imperfect system. Well, we have to acknowledge the fact that if the defense can establish that it was impossible to formulate that specific intent, you have to permit this as a defense. It's really not something where the law is allowing it to occur. It's just recognizing the fact that that's how specific intent works in the law. But I know where you're going with this, because there's been a bill introduced.
There's been a bill introduced again to
eliminate it.
To repeal it, yeah. And in cases, I believe the bill talks about cases of homicide. Mm-hmm. To repeal it in those cases. Yeah. I don't believe it would apply to other cases, but this is a high-profile example of, you know, certainly an egregious situation, and there's no doubt about it. I mean, we have a death. We have what appears to be a strangulation and a sexual assault. And so it gets that attention. But again, is this the type of offense where you say, okay, we're just going to take away a voluntary intoxication defense? A lot of people think to themselves, and I can see a lot of people saying this, well, okay, how can this work? I mean, if you get drunk or if you get high, I mean, you're responsible for your own actions.
Not only that,
right?
But there's the thought that killers, would-be killers, all they got to do is get drunk enough and they'll be insulated from prosecution. Well, first
of all,
it doesn't work that way. But you know what's flat-out dumb about this, Casey, is that the only reason we're even having this controversy is because the prosecutor charged this guy with first-degree intentional homicide, the highest felony, a Class A felony, the only one that we have on our books. It's the harshest penalty in our state. We don't kill people for this, but in other states they do. We do send people to prison for life without parole on these types of charges. You know what they could do? They could just go for 60 years, which would still be a life sentence for this guy, assuming that he's not 10 years old, or whatever. And they don't have to prove specific intent on a reckless homicide.
Right.
You know?
So why are they not doing that? And that was one of my questions. Why didn't the prosecution in this case, and I don't know the answer to this, ask for a lesser included instruction or, as you point out, charge somebody with this offense in the first place? Is it because there was a lot of pressure to charge this as a first degree intentional homicide case? That may well been, because certainly you have an unborn child, right? That's obviously an aggravating circumstance of all this, because you have two lives that you're talking about, not just one. But to me, again, this is another example, and I don't know what's going to happen at the retrial. I mean, who knows? This guy was already convicted of sexual assault, and the jury apparently was tended to in favor of guilt, so perhaps they'll do this. But a lot of times this leads to the type of circumstance that you're talking about, where maybe they'll end up offering something, you know, like a reckless homicide or something along those
lines. They'll get everything they want out of that, and the guy will get convicted if that's the way that it happened. But, you know, here's the thing. That's really kind of what we think of when we're talking about a reckless homicide versus an intentional homicide, is that the person, you know, it would be reckless to drink that much and then just do whatever you're doing in general if it's bad enough to result in someone dying from it. I mean, that's just kind of logical, right? But when you think about first-degree intentional homicide, that means malice aforethought. That means that the person had time to
think
and plan and organize. And, you know, it's the classic, I'm gonna kill somebody, so I go and I buy the gun and I wait for the ATF to certify that I'm able to purchase one, and I go through the cooling off period, and I buy the right kind of ammunition, and I scope out where the person lives. And
now this—I
don't want to imply that I've thought about this a lot, but
we understand. But this, as opposed to, we're talking about voluntary intoxication, as opposed to involuntary intoxication, I talked about the case last week on the show of Carrie Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
Who was Carrie acquitted, Kennedy. By the way.
Found not guilty.
She was found not guilty of impaired driving. And this was based on, essentially, we went over this last week, but basically she had Ambien in her system. She was wearing her gym clothes when she was stopped, or I think, I don't know that she was stopped. I think maybe there was an accident or something to that effect. But in any case, she was wearing her gym clothes. She says that she accidentally took thyroid medication instead of Ambien. To me, what I said last week
the other
week
way
is,
around. She actually took the Ambien instead
actually
of
took the Ambien instead of, excuse me.
Right.
To me, that's a plausible defense.
Sure.
Especially when I think she had a plausible explanation for it. She was going to the gym. You know, why would you be wearing your gym clothes at that time of the day if you weren't going to the gym? And it just it made sense that way. And the jury believed that. The jury believed her story, apparently, because they found her not guilty. So it's one of those situations where that's involuntary. You don't mm-hmm. mean to take it, but you do end up taking
Or, you know, I had a case like this years ago, and it might seem a bit far-fetched for those of us that are experienced in such things, but I was representing a younger person who was barely of age to be able to drink alcoholic beverages and had never heard of a Long Island iced tea before. And have you ever tried such a drink?
Yes, very potent.
And not only that, it is, to an unexperienced drinker, may not even taste like alcohol if it's made well. And it's got a lot of alcohol in it. I mean, that could the person didn't realize what they were drinking was even an alcoholic beverage. It'd be the same sort of thing.
Or if somebody took the date rape drug accidentally.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
Rufinol.
Yeah. Absolutely result in that kind of thing. But, you know, people were talking about the Kennedy case as though it were, you know, some kind of wild, far-fetched thing. I've seen that same scenario come up many times, you know, even just in our own practice. And I think it does happen. You know, you know, with the Ambien, it's one of the most sort of generic looking pills in the sense that it's a very small, very just white with no unique markings on it. Usually Zolpidem is a small pill, and it could very easily be confused with a lot of other ones that look that way. And hey, you know, I can absolutely see that happening. Well, we do have to take another break, Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. This is the final segment already?
This is.
See how that happens? The time?
It just goes by very quickly.
It whizzes by.
Well, there's a bunch of lawyers, defense lawyers that are questioning the results of blood alcohol tests. You and I have done this on many, many different occasions, and there's sort of there's blood testing, and without getting into the details because I don't want to bore the audience, it's called gas chromatography, and when they take two samples of your blood, it's run through one of these instruments, gas chromatograph. And
you don't mean an instrument like a violin?
No, not
or
like
a tuba,
that.
Right?
Like
you
that.
Mean okay? Yeah.
And basically,
like
what it does,
instrument.
Yeah, is there's a vial and it's got a tube top, and it takes a small amount of the vapor off the top of that and runs it through this instrument. And it's very complex in how it works. It's very subject to human error in terms of everything from how the sample is how your blood is collected, to how the sample is prepared, to how the machine is run, to the computer program, to the person operating the machine. All of those things can come into play. Whether there's interference, whether there's actual other substances in the blood, and it essentially spits out what's called a gas chromatogram, which is actually a graph that shows that the separation of what's in your blood, including ethanol and other substances. In any event, you and I, as a matter of routine practice, regularly request the records from the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene or the Wisconsin Crime Laboratory where these instruments are used.
And it's incumbent on us, because it's part of our profession, to learn as much as we can about the science
about the
behind
science.
These things. In fact, you just attended a course in how many days was it? 4 days? Three days?
It was four-day seminar.
Four-day seminar. Hands-on seminar. Hands-on blood seminar type thing. Did you have to test your own blood, or was it somebody else's blood?
Not my own blood.
Okay.
No. There were other substances that we tested.
I see.
But they were not our own blood.
But Casey actually attended this course where they taught him how to conduct gas chromatography.
Yeah.
Using headspace gas chromatography. See how amazing the world can be.
You can learn all these things.
Really dive into your job.
And the father of gas chromatography, the guy who basically started the whole thing, was there.
Professor Gas Chromatography?
Professor Harold McNair.
Oh,
who was there? And he's.
I thought maybe they named it after him.
No, not that. But it's very fascinating, and the science is very complicated, and there's lots of room for error. So, what's happened is in a lot of these charts that have come out, there's been a bunch of little humps, and it's been termed by many defense lawyers the jagged hump, because we're seeing this in a lot of these blood
tests. Is that
what
they mean when they say that? Okay,
yes, that's what they mean.
I was way off base.
Right. It's not what you're thinking, Kirk. It's something different. So that's what happened, and we see these now. Have been seeing them in a lot of different samples that have been analyzed by the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. And so this has been brought up because we don't know. And Perkin Elmer, who actually manufactures the instruments, has apparently come out to the lab and tried to figure out what are these humps and what's going on.
It's almost like a ghost or something that's in the machine.
Right. And they haven't been able to come up with.
They don't know what's causing this phenomenon.
There's been really no explanation for what it is. And the lab just says, essentially, well, it's not a problem. This is just, we don't know what it is, but we know that it's not affecting the person's blood test result.
And they know that because they're saying it's not a
problem.
They're just
saying it's
not a problem. And the reason they're saying it's not a problem is because they don't know what it is.
Because they don't know what it is. Now, this is the same lab, by the way, that failed its proficiency testing in June of 2010. And basically, they're tested by these outside agencies that come in and make sure everything's running.
Oh, you know what, Casey? The reason that we know about that is because they started doing that eventually.
Right.
Because when – and I can tell you, when I was in the military, the methods by which the testing laboratories that are used by the federal government and specifically within the military system, and usually these are for court-martial proceedings where someone's being tried, and then they're using forensic science for this kind of thing. But obviously, gas chromatography is the essence of that type of prosecution as well. But what ends up happening is when things are documented and things are done in such a way where there are procedures and protocols and ways for more than just one person to say, looks good to me, and have outside sources checking it, that's when you start to realize that, you know, this is not a 1+1=2 process. It's very complicated in all the parts that go into it. So what happened over the years is I really developed kind of a specialty in defending these types of scientifically based prosecutions, against these prosecutions. I just learned that there is so much that happens on the inside of the lab that if it's being monitored correctly and if they're actually trying their hardest to be forensically accurate and correct in their reporting, there's a lot of problems will be discovered in that process. So when I came to Wisconsin in 1999 and I started doing investigating these drunk driving cases and looking into the gas chromatography processes here, naturally I wanted to find out how they had done on proficiency testing and how they, and you know what, they weren't doing it. They did not have outside agencies sending them blind samples that they had to report. And the fact that, you know, they had tried numerous times to receive a forensic accreditation from the National Academy of Sciences, and were denied that several times because they didn't have enough of a robust program to demonstrate that things were going well. You know what? So then, when they're trying to get this accreditation going, that's when they start implementing these other procedures. And lo and behold, 2010. Well, and that's not the only time they've had a failed proficiency testing, but you know. One of the errors that was discovered, and I know you want to get into this, but the one that I found most shocking was that there was this error that occurred that they still have no explanation for, and they still can't repeat the result by manipulating every variable they can think of. It just they're unable to replicate that process. And, you know, just applying basic principles of scientific investigation, that's one way of proving that a cause and effect relationship is being able to reproduce that result.
And the state has to prove that. They have to prove
Absolutely.
That because we are, you know, people who are on trial are afforded that presumption of innocence. Now, they haven't even done essentially a root cause analysis to find out, as you point out, what's going on with this jagged hump, as it's been termed? What is this? What even is the substance that the machine is detecting? Is that some type of compound? We don't know what it is. So when you think about this, there are no assumptions in science. Science is not about assumptions.
Right.
Science is about doing experiments. The scientific method is specifically about that. So when you have assumptions that are being made, they're assuming this doesn't have an effect on the ethanol result, on the blood test result, on the alcohol result. We don't know what this is. And lab officials have had the audacity, right? Because people are raising questions about this, they dismiss it as ridiculous. That's what they actually said. They actually said it's ridiculous. What's ridiculous is the fact that not only are they not undergoing, as far as we know, a root cause analysis to this, but they're the ones who are assuming that it's not a problem, and they're making these assumptions without knowing.
Without even knowing what the problem is.
What the problem is.
Now, let's say this was a group of engineers working for NASA, and every time they do a simulation of the space shuttle or some other rocket taking off, you know, it blows up in the simulation. And they come and say, well, our assumption is that this isn't a problem because when we do it for real, it's not going to go that way. Take our word for it because we're scientists.
Right.
I mean, it's the same thing, isn't it?
Right.
It's kind of
Would you get on that flight?
Going,
would you get on that flight?
I would not, as a matter of fact.
And no.
Now, you know what's going to happen? You know, and listeners, do not take any of this to mean that if a law enforcement officer asks you for a sample of your blood that you should say no, because there are penalties for that independent of whether there is anything in your blood, and none of this should be construed as legal advice. But us criticizing the process by which blood is tested and results are generated is something that you should let a lawyer handle. Don't refuse a blood test because of this.
Right. And in this situation, to me, one of the analysts from the State Lab of Hygiene, Laura Lidicote, was quoted by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as saying, I've highlighted the fallacies in the article. And there was an article written by attorney Andrew Mishlove, and I think others as well. And it's pretty highlighted, she said. So that's all she says. I mean, and then she's this... Maybe she said more to the paper, but she said defense attorneys are a very active group, and it's their job to try to discredit the tests, which is difficult when it's as good and solid and accurate as ours. But I'm not okay with them trying to discredit the science. Nobody's trying to discredit the science.
They're talking about something that appears on all of these gas chromatograms that nobody has any explanation for.
But you're darn right that people are going to discredit something if you can't find the explanation for it. And what's the solution? Well, the solution is you take these instruments out of service and you bring in new instruments, okay? Or you take them out of service at least until you can find out what's going on.
You stop convicting people using this evidence while you figure out what the problem is.
Absolutely.
Too, right?
Absolutely. Because we're talking about thousands and thousands of cases.
Sure.
Where people are going to jail and some are going to prison.
Right.
And isn't
that important to make sure we get it done right? Is it worth dismissing because we don't know what it is? That's ludicrous.
So that an innocent person doesn't get convicted?
Well, we all have an interest in making sure that doesn't happen.
We would hope so. Anyway, all right. I'm done with my rant.
Okay.
I think you're done with your rant, right?
Yeah.
We do have
I'll
to
save
go
them up for
week.
Next week.
For next week, of course. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a wonderful weekend.